A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this prompt. He wants us to dig into monocles, pocket watches, and other thoroughly old school accessories you can still buy. Not as costume pieces, but as actual manufactured goods with supply chains and waiting lists and baffling price tags. The kind of thing where you type it into a search bar, assuming you'll get museum results, and instead you get a checkout page. A device that should have died in 1910, and yet here we are.
After they shut down, global production consolidates to a single workshop in Japan for the entire planet's monocle supply. The monocle is the musical equivalent of a harpsichord. Everyone thinks it's extinct, but there's still a guy in Leipzig making them.
Of course there are. So let's define what we're actually talking about here, because old school accessories covers a lot of ground. We're looking at objects that peaked before 1920, but still have active manufacturing, not just resale markets. Three pillars: monocles for optical engineering, pocket watches for mechanical horology, and a wild card, the chatelaine, which is basically a Victorian-era utility belt that predates the Leatherman by about 150 years, which is either the death of the monocle or the birth of a very lucrative side hustle for someone with a CNC machine and too much free time.
Keys, scissors, thimbles, a small notebook, sometimes a watch. It was the EDC, everyday carry system of the 1860s. And here's the thing that makes this whole category interesting. What distinguishes a surviving accessory from a dead one? Because this isn't nostalgia. Nostalgia is buying a rotary phone you never plug in. These are functional precision instruments that people use daily, that require individual fitting and have measurable performance characteristics, and that are objectively worse than their modern alternatives in almost every way. Except for the specific thing they do that nothing else does.
Define objectively worse. The answer, as we're going to dig into, involves a weird intersection of material science, manufacturing economics, and a very specific kind of user psychology. This isn't nostalgia. This is something stranger.
A pocket watch requires you to reach into a pocket, open a case, and read an analog dial. A wristwatch is faster, more secure, and leaves your hands free. Hatpins are sharp objects you wear near your neck. Spats are fabric covers you button over shoes to protect them from mud, in an era of paved roads and Gore-Tex. So these are not big markets, but they are real markets, with real supply chains and real innovation happening inside them.
Something is happening here that isn't just people like old things. It's a precision instrument that happens to look like your great-grandfather's accessories.
The popular understanding is that a monocle works by suction. You squeeze it into your eye socket and it creates a seal, like a tiny plunger for your eyeball. This is completely wrong. There are three basic fit mechanisms, and each one represents a different engineering philosophy. The rimless monocle, which is the classic image most people have, is held in place purely by the tension between the cheekbone and the brow ridge. And that's the suction myth. In reality, a properly fitted monocle uses what opticians call suspension fit. It's held in place by tension against three points of contact: the brow ridge above, the upper cheekbone below, and the side of the nose bridge. The bezel edge is hand-filed to create a very slight irregularity in cross-section, which provides just enough friction against the skin to stay put without any suction at all.
It's a friction fit, not a vacuum seal. We're talking sub-millimeter tolerances that an 1880s craftsman literally could not achieve with the tools of the era.
A monocle that fits me perfectly will just fall off your face. This is why buying a generic monocle online is a complete waste of money. It's like buying shoes in a single size and hoping. You try them on, take a photo of your face with the gauge in place, send it back to them, and they CNC cut the rim to your exact interpupillary distance and facial geometry. That filing process is the part modern manufacturing struggles with. You can CNC machine a monocle frame to within microns of a CAD model, but the final fitting requires handwork.
You're getting a monocle that fits your face better than any Victorian aristocrats ever fit theirs. And the lens itself. We're talking modern anti-reflective coatings, UV protection, scratch-resistant treatments. You can get a monocle with your actual prescription ground into it with coatings that didn't exist until the 1990s. It's a functional medical device disguised as an anachronism.
There's a fact here that I think really drives this home. A properly fitted monocle exerts approximately 0.4 newtons of force on the eye socket. That's less pressure than a typical pair of sunglasses. You can get a perfectly functional pair from an online retailer for $50. Frames, lenses, anti-reflective coating, the works. A monocle is 16 times the price for half the correction and none of the stability.
Yet people wait over a year for one. If your monocle is touching your eyeball, you are doing something catastrophically wrong.
The last major monocle manufacturer in the United States closed in 1952. That was the end of the American Optical Company's monocle division. The movement, the mechanism inside, is fundamentally different from a wristwatch movement in ways that aren't obvious from the outside. Most people assume a pocket watch is just a wristwatch movement in a bigger case, maybe with a chain attached. But the gear train layout is completely different. In a wristwatch, the crown, the winding stem, is at 3 o'clock relative to the dial. In a pocket watch, the crown is at 12 o'clock.
All right, let's move to pocket watches. And this is where the story gets bigger. Because unlike monocles, pocket watches have a substantial market. Herman, you've been deep in the horology weeds on this one.
The pocket watch revival is one of my favorite niche economic stories. The core of it is the mechanical watch boom. In 2015, global mechanical watch sales were about 6.8 million units. In 2025, that number hit 12.4 million. You physically can, and some cheap quartz pocket watches do exactly that. They put a wristwatch movement in a larger case with the crown at 12 o'clock, which means the seconds hand is in the wrong position and the stem has to take an awkward angled path. But a proper pocket watch uses what's called a Lapine caliber if it's open-faced, or a Savinette caliber if it has a hunter case with a spring-loaded lid.
The movements inside these things are fascinating because they're simultaneously ancient and cutting-edge.
The ETA 6498 movement. This is the workhorse of the modern pocket watch world. It's been in continuous production since 1954, which makes it one of the longest-running mechanical movement designs still manufactured anywhere. The Lapine is named after Jean-Antoine Lapine, who designed it in the 1770s. It's thinner, has no second subdial, and is designed for an open-faced case with no lid. The Savinette, French for little soap, because the round hunter case resembled a soap dish, has a hinged lid. You press a button to open, and typically has a small second subdial at 6 o'clock.
Wait, a mechanical movement from a design that predates powered flight is keeping time as accurately as early quartz?
Better materials, better manufacturing. The original 1894 design was brilliant, but it was limited by the metallurgy of its era. This is where the economics get fascinating. Only three companies in the world still produce mechanical pocket watch movements in any real volume. ETA in Switzerland, Seagull in China, and Miyota in Japan. That's it. Three companies supplying the entire global market for new mechanical pocket watches.
Which can be a very large market.
It's not. And here's the key number. A mechanical pocket watch movement costs roughly four times what a comparable wristwatch movement costs, even though the pocket watch movement has fewer parts. A basic ETA wristwatch movement might cost the manufacturer $40 in volume. The equivalent pocket watch movement costs around $160.
Fewer parts but higher cost. That's counterintuitive.
It's entirely about tooling amortization. ETA might sell 500,000 of a popular wristwatch movement in a year. They might sell 5,000 of their pocket watch movement. The cost of designing the movement, creating the tooling, setting up the production line, that's a fixed cost. You spread it across however many units you sell. Fewer units means each unit carries a larger share of that fixed cost.
That tells you something about demand that the standard consumer electronics narrative completely misses. Apple will tell you everyone wants a smartwatch with notifications and heart rate monitoring and a screen that's obsolete in 4 years. The pocket watch movement is more expensive because nobody buys pocket watches, and nobody buys pocket watches because they're more expensive.
That's the vicious circle of niche manufacturing. But it's also what makes the Seagull 1963 reissue so interesting. Seagull produced the original movement for the Chinese Air Force in 1963. It's a column wheel chronograph, which is mechanically superior to the cam-actuated chronographs you find in most affordable mechanical watches. A column wheel chronograph from a Swiss manufacturer would cost you thousands. Seagull sells the reissue pocket watch version for $280.
This is the knowledge bottleneck problem repeating itself across every one of these accessories.
Seagull has been making variants of this movement for over 60 years. The fixed costs are long since recovered. They're essentially selling the movement at near marginal cost, which is the cost of materials and labor. The crown is in the wrong position, the subdial layout makes no sense, and the case is usually chrome-plated brass that'll wear through in 6 months. On the other end, you've got $15,000-plus mechanical pieces from Patek and Bacheron, and that's basically the Seagull 1963. It's not a replica or a reissue in the cosmetic sense. It's the same movement architecture, still in production, in a slightly updated case.
Killed by the smartphone. If you want a timepiece that costs between $500 and $2,000, you buy an Apple Watch or a nice wristwatch. You don't carry a pocket watch in that price range because it doesn't do anything your phone doesn't do, and it's less convenient. The pocket watch survives at the luxury end because it's not competing on function. It's competing on craftsmanship.
The entry point for pocket watches is also surprisingly accessible. The Reddit Pocket Watch Revival of 2023 to 2025 is a case study in how communities drive niche markets in the first year. And that's not a Kickstarter project by some enthusiast in a garage. That's a proper brand revival with distribution, marketing, warranty support. The economics work because the target market isn't price sensitive. These are people who have decided they want a pocket watch, and they're willing to pay a premium for something that isn't just a vintage piece with unknown service history. Then you spend about $200 on a full service, cleaning, oiling, regulation. And for under $400 total, you have a fully functional mechanical timepiece that's already 100 years old and will last another 100. This is where the metallurgy gets interesting. An original 1915 Elgin pocket watch case is typically coined silver, 90% silver, which is softer and tarnishes differently than modern stainless steel.
That's the part where the economics get really interesting. We've covered how they're made. The more interesting question is, why are they still being made? The economics of selling 500 monocles a year are deeply unusual. How does a company stay in business doing that?
High margin per unit, minimal overhead, and a side business that actually pays the bills. Let's break down the monocle economics. It's more reliable, more accurate, and requires less maintenance. But the original has the thing collectors actually want, which is the patina of age and the connection to history. The coin silver case develops a specific kind of tarnish that modern stainless never will. The hand-engraved serial number connects to a specific moment in American manufacturing history. You're not buying a timepiece, you're buying provenance. They're searching for where to buy a monocle. On Google, they end up on niche forums. They get referred by word of mouth. Anglo-American Optical doesn't run Facebook ads. They don't need to.
The side business is eyewear repair and custom optical work. Make the case for the monocle as a practical object.
I'm not sure I can make the case for the monocle specifically. But the pocket watch? There are actual use cases where it's superior to a wristwatch. If you work in an environment where your wrist is constantly moving, surgery, certain kinds of machining, cooking, a pocket watch is easier to read without interrupting your workflow. You don't have to rotate your wrist, you just glance down. There's a reason nurses traditionally wore pocket watches pinned to their scrubs.
The pocket watch is basically a halo product for watch companies. It's not their main revenue driver, but it generates attention. It reinforces brand heritage, and it brings in customers who might later buy a wristwatch.
Watchmakers and jewelers historically used monocle-style loops for exactly this reason. Pop it in, examine the piece, pop it out. But that's a loop, not a prescription monocle. The prescription monocle is purely an aesthetic choice. He hand-bends each frame from German silver, which despite the name is actually a nickel-silver alloy containing no real silver. The actual market breaks down into three distinct groups. First, historical reenactors and costumers. These are the people driving the $2 million a year hatpin market in the US. They need period-accurate accessories, and they're willing to pay for quality reproductions. Second, what I'd call the tailoring subculture. Men who are into bespoke suits, traditional barbering, mechanical watches.
This is where the fragility of these supply chains becomes concerning. We mentioned the single CNC machine in the UK that makes most of the world's monocle rims. The pince-nez supply depends on one craftsman in Vienna. A cryptographic handshake.
If you see someone wearing a pocket watch with a three-piece suit, and you know enough to recognize whether it's a Lepine or a Savonette, you've just identified yourself as part of the same subculture.
Which is simultaneously terrifying and kind of wonderful. It means that if you buy a monocle today, you are participating in a craft tradition that is literally one retirement away from extinction. There's something almost sacred about that.
Let's talk about the cultural engineering side of this, because the mechanical and economic explanations only get you so far. These accessories aren't just functional, they signal a specific identity. And the third group is the one that I think is most interesting from a manufacturing perspective, people who are simply contrarian about technology. They carry fountain pens, they wear mechanical watches, they shave with safety razors.
There was that study last year, the Journal of Consumer Research piece.
2024 study from the Journal of Consumer Research. They showed participants photos of engineers and asked them to rate perceived competence and trustworthiness. Right, but I think analog revival undersells what's happening. These aren't people who reject technology. They're people who are selective about which technologies they adopt, and they apply a different set of criteria than does this work faster or cheaper. They're asking, does this reward skill? Does it create friction that makes the experience more meaningful? Does it connect me to a tradition of craft?
That's a big enough market to sustain multiple companies making mechanical pocket watch movements.
It's a big enough market to sustain three companies, plus a handful of boutique manufacturers doing runs of a few hundred units.
Like adopting a feral cat. The difficulty is the point.
In 2010, if you wanted to make a run of 200 pocket watch cases, you were looking at tooling costs that made it completely uneconomical. Today, with 5-axis CNC machining and 3D printed wax patterns for lost wax casting, you can do it.
Walk me through that. The mid-range, $500 to $2,000, is mostly dead, as we said. If you want a mechanical pocket watch at a reasonable price, your best bet is actually vintage. There are thousands of well-maintained American pocket watches from the early 1900s. Elgin, Hamilton, Illinois. Watch company that sell for $200 to $800 and keep excellent time.
So a run of 200 cases goes from impossible to justify to slightly more expensive per unit, but totally viable. A 5-axis CNC mill can produce complex geometries in a single setup that would have required multiple setups and custom fixturing on a 3-axis mill. The machine is expensive, but the programming and setup time per part has dropped dramatically.
The pocket watch isn't just a fashion statement or a horological curiosity. It's a privacy-preserving timekeeping device. That's a framing that would have made no sense 20 years ago, but in a world of always connected wearables, it's compelling.
For a monocle bezel with its specific edge profile, or a pocket watch case with complex internal geometry for the movement, this is the difference between we can't make this and we can make this for a few hundred dollars. The Horological Society data shows that watch repair schools are actually growing. Enrollment was up 12% in 2024 compared to 2020. Young people are learning to service mechanical watches. If you're looking at Etsy or eBay, and you see a Chatelaine listed as new, check the chain links. If they're simple oval links, it's a modern reproduction that will tangle.
Which means the pocket watch you buy today has a realistic chance of being serviceable for the entire rest of your life. Name one piece of consumer electronics you can say that about.
You can't. There isn't one. Even high-end audio equipment eventually runs into capacitor failure and obsolete components, but a mechanical watch movement from 1890 uses the same principles and many of the same parts as one from 2025. The continuity is staggering.
All right, let's shift to the practical side of this. All of this is fascinating in theory, but if you're actually thinking about buying one of these things, there are some very specific things you need to know.
Let's start with monocles. If you want one, do not buy a costume monocle from Amazon. I cannot stress this enough. Those are made with generic spring tension and no fitting whatsoever. The bridge won't match your face, the tension will be wrong, and it will fall off constantly. You'll conclude that monocles are uncomfortable and impractical when the real problem is that you bought a toy instead of a precision instrument.
The correct path is to go to Anglo-American Optical, or a custom optician who handles monocle fittings. Expect to pay between $200 and $400. You'll need to provide your prescription if you need vision correction. The fitting process involves that plastic gauge I mentioned earlier, and it takes about 2 to 3 weeks from measurement to delivery. You will also need to spend those 2 to 3 weeks training your corrugator supercilii muscle. It will feel strange at first. That's normal.
For pocket watches, the best entry point is not a new one. It's a vintage American movement from the golden age of American watchmaking. Elgin, Waltham, Hamilton, these companies produced millions of high-quality pocket watch movements between 1900 and 1950. They're abundant, they're affordable, and they're fully serviceable. There's a whole subculture of cyclists who carry antique hatpins in their repair kits. It's the most unexpectedly practical crossover I've encountered in researching this episode. The total will be between $200 and $400 for a timepiece that will outlive you.
What should people watch out for when buying vintage?
A hatpin is a better emergency tire lever than anything you can buy at a bike shop. A pocket watch is easier to read in certain professional contexts than a wristwatch. Okay, the monocle is harder to defend on purely functional grounds. They're often sold on eBay without service history and described as running, when they really mean the balance wheel moves if you shake it. Avoid anything without a clear service history. The monocle is pure signal, but that doesn't make it less interesting. The fact that a market exists for an object whose only function is to communicate, "I am the kind of person who wears a monocle," tells you something about how human signaling works. It's not enough to be wealthy or educated or eccentric.
For pince-nez, the options are even narrower.
The only reliable new manufacturer is Optik Klinger in Vienna. They ship worldwide. The wait list is approximately 6 months, and the price runs between 350 and 500 euros. The monocle is the most efficient signaling device in the accessory world. It communicates, "I am not bound by contemporary norms of practicality," in a single glance. That's worth $800 and a 14-month wait to about 800 people a year.
Which brings us back to the Birmingham factory. If global demand is 800 units and Japan can only supply 200, what happens to the other 600 customers?
That's the open question. Some of them will go to the vintage market. Some will buy the generic online monocles that don't fit properly and give up. Some will find opticians who can modify existing frames. And some will wait. But the gap creates an opportunity. If you're a precision machinist with an interest in eyewear, you could probably build a business filling that gap. The Birmingham factory's equipment might even be available.
Someone should buy their tooling.
The lens edger alone is probably from the 1950s and built like a tank. Those machines don't wear out, they just need maintenance, and the knowledge of how to use them is the scarcer resource. When the Birmingham factory closes, the bigger loss isn't the equipment, it's the people who know how to hand file a monocle bezel to fit an individual orbital rim. Rolex, Patek Philippe, Swatch Group. These companies aren't going anywhere, and they have a vested interest in maintaining the watchmaking trade. As long as mechanical wristwatches exist, pocket watches will exist as a niche within that niche.
The monocle and the pince-nez are in a more precarious position. They don't have a large industry propping them up. They're sustained by a handful of craftspeople and a very small, very dedicated customer base. If that CNC machine in the UK fails and can't be repaired, does anyone build a replacement? If the Viennese pince-nez maker retires without an apprentice, does the knowledge just disappear?
There's precedent for both outcomes. Some crafts die and stay dead. Others get rediscovered, with a twist. In most skilled trades, there's still a market pulling for the skill. We need plumbers and electricians. The market for monocle fitting is 800 people a year. That's not enough to sustain a pipeline of apprentices. You need someone who's willing to learn the skill for reasons other than market demand. Personal obsession, cultural preservation, sheer stubbornness.
The kind of person who waits 14 months for a handmade monocle, basically. You're saying this is worth preserving. Every purchase is a tiny act of cultural conservation.
The privacy angle is the wild card here. If you want a functional monocle, one that actually stays on your face and corrects your vision, do not buy one online. The generic ones are almost always the wrong size for your orbital rim, and they'll either fall off constantly or be so uncomfortable you'll never wear them.
The same logic applies to pocket watches. We're moving toward a world where every device is connected, every device is tracking you, every device is reporting back to a server somewhere. A pocket watch is a tiny rebellion against that. What should someone expect to pay?
For a proper custom-fitted monocle with a prescription lens, somewhere between $400 and $1,000, depending on the frame material and the lens complexity. The frame itself is the expensive part because of the hand-fitting. The lens is just a standard round lens blank, which any optical lab can cut. The pocket watch guy isn't monetizing your wrist.
The oldest tech really might be the most future-proof. Not because it's better at telling time. A quartz watch is objectively more accurate than any mechanical movement, but because it's better at being owned. It respects the relationship between object and owner, in a way that connected devices fundamentally don't.
On the vintage side, you can find a serviced Elgin or Waltham from the 19-teens or 20s for between $200 and $500 on eBay. They don't harvest data or serve ads or become obsolete on a schedule determined by a product manager in Cupertino. They're tools in the pre-digital sense. That's a great approach that a lot of people don't know about. Search for NOS New Old Stock Pocket Watch Movements on eBay.
That's a good place to land. If you're interested in any of this, the practical takeaways are straightforward. For monocles, go to Anglo American Optical. Budget $200 to $400. Expect a fitting process. Train your eyebrow muscle. For pocket watches, start with a vintage American movement from a reputable dealer, Elgin, Waltham, Hamilton, and get it properly serviced. For pince-nez, contact Optik Klinger in Vienna and be prepared to wait. New old stock. I'm going to remember that.
It's one of those search terms that unlocks a whole hidden world. NOS movements, NOS dials, NOS hands. There's an entire ecosystem of parts that were manufactured decades ago and never used. They're time capsules. The answer depends partly on whether enough people decide that these objects are worth preserving. Not as museum pieces, but as functional alternatives to a world of disposable, surveilling technology. Every purchase is a vote. Cast yours carefully.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
During the Cold War, Soviet chess authorities became alarmed that the ancient Persian board game, Nard, a variant of backgammon, was experiencing a behavioral resurgence among factory workers in Réunion, who reportedly played it during shifts as a form of passive resistance to French colonial labor oversight, leading the KGB to briefly classify Nard's strategy manuals as subversive literature.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, rate us 5 stars and tell a friend who still wears a wristwatch. We'll be back next week.
Produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.